Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 176 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be continuing a comprehensive USMLE Step 1 Cardiology Review Series. So this will be Series 6. And this will actually be the Cardiac Embryology Podcast as promised. And then one thing I'll go ahead and say is I'm actually attaching a slide. It's just a sync, like two slides literally, to this podcast, so you can download it at the bottom on the website. And basically the thing I just show a diagram as I promised in the prior cardiac podcast that details the pathophysiology behind the tetralogy of Fallot. This is just a diagram I've always used to explain that concept to people, and it has really helped a lot of people have that idea stick in their minds very well. Okay. So let's jump right into cardiac embryology, right? So the thing is, I will make another podcast, hopefully in the future, that details like the embryology, like how you go from like essentially like day zero to day 21 or something like that. I will do that later. But basically, to describe the embryology of the heart, let's kind of start in week four, right? And an easy way to remember that is week four, right? Four chambers. The heart has four chambers. So that's just a nice way to keep that in mind. So the thing is, basically, right, there are all these body foldings that occur prior to week four, right? And after all those body foldings have happened, there is a straight blood vessel that forms. That straight blood vessel will eventually become the heart. And it's actually formed in the ventral portion of the body, right? So it's formed in the anterior body wall. And the thing is, this blood vessel, blood actually flows in it in a caudal to cranial direction. So it flows from the bottom to the top, okay? So it should essentially make sense, right? If we're dealing with a straight tube that's ultimately going to become the heart, the most caudal structure should be like a blood returning structure, like a vein, right? A structure that returns blood to the heart like a vein. And really the embryologic name for this is the sinus venosus. Now, on the flip side, it should also make sense that the most cranial structure should be like some kind of blood removing structure, right? Some kind of blood removing structure like an artery, right? And it so happens that the embryologic name for this is the truncus arteriosus, okay? So sinus venosus, kind of like a vein, truncus arteriosus, kind of like an artery. Although the thing is, the thing that I guess maybe throws in a little wrench here is that the beginning of the truncus arteriosus actually has a special name, and it's known as the bulbus cordis. The bulbus cordis is just almost like a subset of the truncus arteriosus. It's the very beginning of it. And then we have the future atria, future ventricles. They are like derived from the primitive atria and ventricle. So the thing is, as the heart tube, again, as this straight tube develops, right, the primitive atria, the primitive ventricles, they get larger, right? And the way they actually get larger is by assimilating nearby structures, right? The way I kind of think about it is almost like a gentrification sort of thing. It's like, okay, you know what? I want to expand my property by buying surrounding properties and kind of bringing them under my umbrella. That's essentially what happens with the primitive atria and ventricles. They get bigger by just assimilating their close cousins, right? So the primitive atria, they incorporate some part of the sinus venosus into the adult final atria, right? And one thing that actually helps here, that again, occasionally your friends at the MBME may throw on the USMLE exams, is that the lumina of the primitive atria prior to that assimilation of the sinus venosus, it's purely rough. But the lumina of that sinus venosus itself, prior to assimilation into the primitive atria, is purely smooth. So the thing is that the assimilation of some parts of the sinus venosus is the primary mechanism behind us observing why you may have like rough-walled and smooth-walled regions of the atria, right? The rough-walled regions of the atria, those are your pectinic muscles. The smooth-walled regions, those are the parts that are derived from the incorporated sinus venosus. And really, pretty much the same thing happens in the ventricles, although the only difference is that the structure that is assimilated is the bulbus cordis, right? Again, remember, the bulbus cordis, I said, was the beginning of the truncus arteriosus. Now, the thing is, as that heart tube, again, that straight tube gets bigger and bigger, a specific kind of folding occurs. Some people call it cardiac looping. And essentially, the atria, right? Remember, I said blood flows, at least in that straight tube, blood flowed in a caudal to cranial direction, right? The thing is, the atria that were at some point caudal, they fold in a way that makes them like posterior and superior. Okay, so posterior and superior. The way I remember that is PSA. And then the other one is the other one. So atria folds posterior and superior. And then the ventricles, remember again, they are the things that ultimately squirt blood, right, from the heart. So they were the most cranial part of this business that I talked about earlier, right? So the ventricles, they were at some point cranial. They actually fold in a way that makes them anterior and inferior, okay? So atria fold in a way that makes them posterior and superior. Ventricles fold in a way that makes them anterior and inferior, right? So it should actually then make sense to you why arteries leave from the front wall of the heart in an adult. Because again, remember, these arteries drain ventricles, right? And then kind of like the reverse case is what obtains for veins. So now that we've kind of talked about how the heart is set up, let's talk about how blood flows in utero. So let's talk about this in steps, right? So let's talk through like a couple of steps here. So step one essentially is the ultimate source of oxygen for the fetus is the placenta, right? And the deoxygenated blood is delivered, the placenta gives blood to the umbilical arteries. That's step one. And then in step two, when the umbilical arteries pick up this blood, let me back up for a second here. Let me collect my thoughts. So the thing is, the placenta is where gas exchange occurs in the fetus. I'll throw that out there. Now, the thing is, that blood, the deoxygenated blood that makes its way to the placenta to get oxygenated, comes there through the umbilical arteries. That's actually very high yield to know. And then after the blood gets oxygenated, it gets taken away in step two via the umbilical veins, right? So umbilical veins, they have the highest oxygen tension of all the blood vessels in the body. So the umbilical veins picks up that blood, right? And that blood ultimately flows to the IVC, right? But the thing is, as the blood flows to the IVC, the blood in the umbilical vein actually bypasses the portal circulation, right? Remember, the portal circulation deals with blood from the lower body, right? So an important shunt is taken by the umbilical veins, essentially, as it routes blood all the way to the IVC. This shunt is known as the doctor's venosus. The thing is, your friends at the MBME, they may put sinus venosus as an answer choice. Don't fall for that, right? And then in step three, the blood in the IVC, again, I'm trying to break this up into discrete steps so that you can follow this thing up very closely. So in step three, the blood in the inferior vena cava, it actually flows into the right atrium, and then it goes through the foramen ovale, more on that later, to the left atrium. And then from the left atrium, that blood flows to the left ventricle, and then from the left ventricle to the ascending aorta, and from the ascending aorta to the rest of the body. Now, that's IVC blood. Let's talk about SVC blood in step four. So the thing is, blood from your upper body, right? It drains into the right atrium through the SVC. Now, this blood actually does not take the pathway of the foramen ovale for the most part. Okay, it doesn't take the pathway of the foramen ovale for the most part. It goes from the right atrium. So SVC blood comes into the right atrium. And then after that, it goes into the right ventricle. And then it enters the pulmonary artery, right? And the thing is, you may say, oh, Divine, shouldn't this go to the lungs? It actually does not. Because remember, when a kid is in utero, right, this kid's lungs essentially don't work, right? And if the lungs are not working, that's like a hypoxic condition. Well, hypoxia causes pulmonary vasoconstriction. So that vasoconstriction makes it essentially impossible for blood to make its way to the lungs, right? So the thing that happens is that the blood in the pulmonary artery actually finds its way to the part of the aorta that is distal. This is very high yield. That is distal to the arch, distal to the aortic arch. And the way that the blood from the pulmonary artery makes its way to the part of the aorta that is distal to the aortic arch is through another shunt known as the doctus arteriosus. Now, the thing is, for purposes of understanding, it's actually kind of high yield to know that the blood that comes into the heart through the IVC, again, I've kind of mentioned this already, but I think repetition always helps, right? The blood that comes into the heart through the IVC and the blood that comes in through the SVC, they actually don't mix until you get to that region, as I've mentioned already, until you get to the region of the aorta that is distal to the aortic arch. So you may say, Divine, what's the use of not letting them mix in the heart when they are ultimately going to mix just outside the heart. You'd be like, why don't you just mix early and then let's get this over with? Well, think about this for a second. The mixing outside, the mixing of this blood, the SVC-IVC blood, they mix outside the heart, distal to the aortic arch. The thing is, if you really think about it, right, the aortic arch itself, it gives rise to blood vessels that feed the brain. And I mean, the brain is very important in development, uses a ton of oxygen, right? Brain is very important, needs high oxygen tension so that it can function properly and it can develop properly. After your brain receives oxygen-rich blood, the body is like, okay, fine, we can mix things after that. So essentially the reason, the pathophysiological reasoning behind the SVC and the IVC blood mixing distal to the arch is so that you can give the brain more oxygen-rich blood so that proper development can happen. So what are the things that then happen after a baby is born, right? After a baby is born, the umbilical arteries close, okay? The umbilical arteries become the medial, so medial with an L at the end, the medial umbilical ligaments, okay? And then if the umbilical arteries close, and then there's no more blood return from the placenta, right? The umbilical vein, the ductus venosus, those both close as well, right? Remember that the umbilical vein becomes the ligamentum teres, okay? And then the ductus venosus becomes the ligamentum venosum, okay? So please don't mix those up. And then the thing is, the high pressures that develop in the left heart, right? The left side of the heart, that actually pushes the foramen ovale shut, and then that's what gives rise to the fossa ovalis in the adult. Now, the thing is, the high pressures that you see in the left heart, they ultimately get transmitted to the aorta, right? So if those high pressures now exist in the aorta, that shunt that existed, the ductus arteriosus, where blood flowed from the pulmonary artery to the aorta, that shunt actually reverses, because again, there are much higher pressures in the aorta. Blood then flows from the aorta to the pulmonary artery through that ductus arteriosus. Although one thing that also happens is that instead of the hypoxia, right, that's existing when the kid is in utero, right, there's enough oxygen tension when the kid gets born, right? So that high level, that high oxygen tension, one thing it actually does is that it actually causes the release, it inhibits the production of prostaglandins. But on the flip side, it also encourages the production of catecholamines like norepinephrine. And then that causes constriction of the ductus arteriosus so that it kinks off and then becomes the ligamentum arteriosum. So again, let's summarize some fetal adult structural derivatives, because this is something that they test all the time on exams, right? So when the right and left, remember there's one umbilical vein and two umbilical arteries, right? So when the right and left umbilical veins close, right, they form the medial with an L at the end, umbilical ligaments, okay? And then when the umbilical vein closes, the umbilical vein becomes the ligamentum teres of the liver. When the ductus venosus closes, it becomes the ligamentum venosum. When the foramen ovale closes, it becomes the fossa ovalis. And then when the ductus arteriosus closes, it becomes the ligamentum arteriosum. Again, these are all floridly high yield things to know for purposes of the exam. So now let's talk about how the actual heart develops, right? Let's talk about how the actual heart develops. So the thing is, the heart actually, for the most part, starts out as kind of like a two-chamber tube, okay? Starts out as a two-chamber tube with like a primitive atrium, primitive ventricle, okay? Now the thing is, this two-chambered heart ultimately becomes a four-chambered heart, okay? By atrial septation. Right, so you basically like put a septum between the two, between the atria, so they can form a right and a left atrium, and this actually happens between weeks 4 and 6, and then also you have a ventricular septation, which happens between weeks 5 and 7. Now the first thing that happens is separation of the atrioventricular canal, right? Essentially, it's basically the region between the primitive atria, primitive ventricles, right? So you separate the atrioventricular canal into like two parts, right, that will essentially serve as the right and left sides of the heart, right? So around the area of the atrioventricular canal, you just divvy up the heart into a right side and a left side, okay? And the way this happens is you actually have ingrowth of tissue from the walls of the heart tube. And the thing is, these tissue ingrowths, they have a special name. They're known as endocardial cushions, Okay, and it's actually very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam that these endocardial quotients are derived from neurocrest cells. Okay, and people that have Down syndrome, the most common cardiac anomaly they have is something called an endocardial quotient defect. Now, after this, actually, I may have misspoken a little earlier. So, I said that the first thing that happens is that you separate the atria from the ventricles. Okay, and again, when you separate the atria from, let me make it very clear. So, you separate the atria from the ventricles. So, that means the separation that comes between should be a canal that divides the atrium from the ventricles, right? AKA the atrioventricular canal. And the atrioventricular canal is derived from neurocrest cells, right? Because it's the endocardial quotients that makes that happen. So essentially, it's almost like from the right and left sides of the heart tube, you have this infolding of tissue, that like ingrowths of tissue, and then they divide the atria from the ventricles. So the next step that then happens is that, okay, you're like, okay, I got to divide the atria into two, right? So the thing is, if you're dividing the atria into two, you need to fulfill two requirements. You can't just divide the right and left atrium willy-nilly. You actually need to divide it in a way that makes sense. So what is the way that makes sense? Well, the way that makes sense must fulfill two conditions, right? The first condition is you want to build a wall between both atria, but you also still want to maintain some communication for oxygenated blood movement purposes, right? So you still want oxygenated blood to be able to move between the right atrium and the left atrium. And then you also want to have a mechanism in place. So this is the second criteria. You need to have a mechanism in place to close that wall when the child is born so that you don't keep having communications between the right atrium and the left atrium, okay? The thing is, the dividing wall between both atria is actually made by two septa that I'm going to discuss right now, actually. So let's talk about this process. And again, this is one of those areas where, you know, you want to kind of pay close attention, maybe listen to this a couple of times so that it kind of sticks in your brain well, right? I mean, obviously, I'm just going to say it right off the bat, right? If a person has issues with this atrial septation, that's an ASD. Remember, ASD, white fixed plate, S2 heart sound, easy peasy on exams. So what happens in step one, right? Informing this atrial septa, right? Again, pay attention to these terms. The thing is, in step one, again, I want to chunk it down into steps. So in step one, you have a septum that grows down towards the endocardial quotients. Remember, I said those are the endocardial quotients from the atrioventricular canal. So you have a septum that grows down towards the endocardial quotients from the top. This septum, right, it's the first septum. It's known as septum primum. Now, the thing is, the septum primum actually does not completely grow down to the endocardial quotients. It doesn't grow all the way down. So there's some leftover space between the bottom of the septum primum and the endocardial quotients. This leftover space where the septum primum essentially does not grow down to is what's known as the foramen primum. Okay? Foramen primum. Foramen primum just means first hole. Now, for purposes of understanding something I'll describe later, the septum primum is actually very thin. Remember that. Write that down somewhere. The septum primum is actually very thin. So now let's jump to step two. So for step two, over time, right, apoptosis actually starts happening in the upper part of the septum primum. And as apoptosis happens, you actually form a new hole. This new hole, notice it's the second hole that is forming. So it's known as the foramen secundum. Foramen secundum for second hole. The thing is, after this apoptosis occurs and you form the second hole, the foramen secundum, the lower part of the septum primum actually grows to reach the endocardial cushion. This sequence of events, I mean, it should hopefully make some sense, right? Because if you had complete downgrowth of the septum primum before the apoptotic event that happens at the top, that will essentially prevent any kind of right to left heart communication, right? And obviously the fetus will die under those circumstances. So that's what happens in step two. Now in step three, as the septum primum keeps growing down to reach the endocardial cushions, again, keep this thing is almost like a time-lapse series of events. So as the septum primum, as it keeps growing down, a new septum actually grows to the right of it. Okay, so the septum primum is growing down to cover over the area that was the foramen primum, okay? And then a new septum begins to grow to the right of the septum primum. Because this is a second septum, it's known as the septum secundum. Now, it is super high yield to know that this septum secundum is actually much thicker than the septum primum. Okay? The septum secundum is much thicker than the septum primum. Okay? And the thing is, this septum secundum that grows, again, it grows to the right anatomically of septum primum, it actually grows about halfway down the distance that is covered by the septum primum. So it effectively covers over the foramen secundum. I'll say that again. We have the septum primum form, right? It grows down, but it doesn't grow all the way down to the endocardial cushions. So there's a space left behind. That's known as the foramen primum. After that, the upper part of the septum primum has some apoptosis happen to form a second hole. That's known as the foramen secundum. And then, after that apoptosis happens, the lower part of the septum primum grows all the way down to the endocardial cushions. Now, as that growing all the way down is happening, a second septum is forming to the right of the septum primum. It's known as the second septum or the septum secundum. Now, this septum secundum only grows halfway down. It grows from top to bottom. It only grows halfway down. So it essentially covers over the foramen secundum, right? It covers over the foramen secundum. So if you're following along with my explanation, you say, Divine, won't this block off communication between the right and left sides of the heart? Well, hold your horses. There is actually an explanation for this, right? So what's that explanation? The thing is, if you think about it, the right side of the heart in utero receives blood from the placenta and the upper and lower extremities, right? So really a ton of blood flows into the right side of the heart. On the flip side, the actual only source of blood for the left side of the heart is blood that's coming from the lungs, which is very minuscule, right? So the thing is, the pressures on the right side of the heart vastly exceed the pressures on the left side of the heart when a child is in utero. And remember I said a few moments earlier that the septum primum is thin while the septum secundum is thick. Again, I'll say that again. The septum primum is thin while the septum secundum is thick. So the thing that happens is that the higher pressures on the right side of the heart actually push down, like they are strong enough to push down the septum primum, which effectively allows blood to almost flow like in a valve-like mechanism from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart. Okay? Just the way to illustrate this is almost like take one of your hands and have your index finger pointing, like the index finger for like your left hand pointing down, the index finger for your right hand pointing up, and then let your fingers, like the tips of your fingers, overlap each other, right? The septum primum is thin, the septum secundum is thick. So the thing is, if the pressures on the right side of the heart are very high, that pressure is high enough to push down the septum primum, and that will create some space for blood to zip right past from the right atrium to the left atrium, okay? So this valve-like mechanism that now exists, okay, is what is known as foramen ovale, okay? This valve-like mechanism that exists is what is known as foramen ovale, because again, the septum secundum, when it grows down, it actually covers over the area that is known as the foramen secundum, right? So that area is gone. Right? But the thing is, it can be opened periodically by the high pressures in the right atrium. Those high pressures can pound down on the septum primum, and that will is temporarily, not all the time, temporarily, that's why it's a valve, okay? That will temporarily pull the septum primum and the septum secundum apart so that blood can flow from the right atrium to the left atrium. This valve-like mechanism is what is known as the foramen ovale. So if you think about it, when the pressure situation is kind of reversed at birth, right, where you have higher pressures on the left side of the heart, lower pressures on the right side of the heart, well, the thing is, those higher pressures on the left side, they actually push down on the foramen ovale, right? And this essentially shuts off the valve, right? And then the foramen ovale receives a new name at this point, aka the fossa ovalis. So it should hopefully make some sense that the foramen ovale contains only tissue that is derived from the thin septum primum, right? So this should again actually make sense and help you understand why the fossa ovalis is thin relative to the remaining parts of the dividing wall between the two atria in the adult, between the right atrium and the left atrium. So let's talk about how we form the interventricular septum. This one is a lot easier, right? So the interventricular septum, kind of like we had for the atria, right? We need to divide the ventricle into two parts, okay? Remember, the right ventricle actually feeds the pulmonary artery, and the left ventricle actually feeds the aorta, right? Remember, the aorta is a much larger blood vessel. So with these two different outflow tracts, right, it should make sense that there should be some kind of divisor between not just the right ventricle and the left ventricle, but there should also be a divisor between the aorta and the pulmonary arteries, okay? So, or the pulmonary artery, because it's one thing. So let's, again, chunk this down into some steps I've essentially created myself. So in step one, the thing that happens is you have your muscular interventricular septum grow from the bottom up, okay? And this is probably a good time to look at the graphic that I post, that I'm posting with this podcast, because it kind of highlights the key events here as well, right? So you have a muscular interventricular septum. It grows from the bottom up and divides up a part, not all, a part of the right, a part of the ventricles. And then in step two, you have a septum that grows from top to bottom. Remember, the muscular interventricular septum grew from bottom to top. In step two, you have a septum that grows from the top to bottom. And that septum actually works in a nifty way. The first thing it does is it actually divides the aorta and the pulmonary trunk. Okay, that's why it should make sense that it should be known as the aortico-pulmonary septum. And then after he has divided the aorta and the pulmonary artery from each other, it keeps proceeding downwards even more to divide the rest of the ventricle. The thing is, the portion of the aortico-pulmonary septum that actually divides the ventricles is what's actually known as the membranous interventricular septum. It is actually, again, very high yield to know for the purposes of step one that the aortico-pulmonary septum is derived from neurocrest cells. You may say, Divine, you keep saying it's very high yield, it's very high yield, it's very high yield. Let me tell you this. Of all the embryology that's tested on the USMLE step one, probably the highest yield is cardiac embryology, neuroembryology, and then GI. But cardiac embryology is probably the highest yield of them all. That's why I'm literally making a podcast just on cardiac embryology. Okay, so do not forget, the aortico-pulmonary septum is actually derived from neurocrest cells. Now, it is actually very high yield for understanding to keep in mind that the aortico-pulmonary septum, it actually grows down in exactly the same longitudinal axis as the muscular interventricular septum. So they essentially meet like perfectly in the midline. When they don't meet perfectly, you begin to have a lot of problems arising, like the tetralogy of Fallot. Remember, in my last cardiac podcast, I promised, I think it was either the last one or two podcasts before, that I will give you a diagram that explains this whole tetralogy of Fallot business. Well, here's the time. Again, it's attached at the bottom of this podcast. You can download it on the website. So the tetralogy of Fallot, right, is essentially like a very important cyanotic congenital heart defect that has four clinical findings, right? And again, everyone memorizes this: pulmonary stenosis, overriding aorta, VSD, right? So like a ventricular septal defect from the membranous part of the interventricular septum, and then right ventricular hypertrophy, right? And then some people may say, oh, these are such disparate findings. But actually, if you, again, understand the diagram that I'm adding at the end of this podcast, and you understood what I guess maybe I've described in the prior podcast, I kind of like described the diagram in words in the preceding podcast, you will actually see that all these things we're observing, they're actually not unrelated in any way, shape, or form. They're actually derivatives of one central problem. And the thing is, it's actually much easier to remember the four findings in tetralogy of Fallot if you understand the underlying pathophysiology. And again, remember, four findings, right? That's why it's called a tetralogy in the first place. And what is this underlying problem? The underlying problem is that the aortico-pulmonary septum fails to meet the muscular interventricular septum in the center, as it should. The thing that happens is that the aortic pulmonary septum is actually displaced off to the right. Once you understand this, like literally like every other thing that relates to tetralogy of Fallot just makes perfect sense in your mind, right? And again, I'm kind of like harping on this because it kind of illustrates a concept that I talked about when I made a podcast. It's one of my older podcasts that I call The Central Dogma of Studying, where I talk about strategies that I suggest for people to think about when they're setting up a study plan, studying for exams, studying in med school. The thing is, it's very easy to fall into a pattern of, oh, I'm just going to memorize this code and move on with my life in med school. The thing is, it actually makes more sense to try to understand what you're doing. Because if you understand the material on your first pass through that material and then make multiple passes, you will almost invariably do really well in med school. That is essentially what I did all through my med school days. I understood the material on the first pass, had like a slow, nice first pass where I understood the material. And then I just made repeated passes prior to any exam. And then obviously I also started focusing on test taking strategy, especially when I jumped into the world of step one, step two, CK, and step three. So again, this diagram kind of illustrates everything I've talked about. Because again, if you the thing I describe here as APS, the aortic pulmonary septum, it grows down, it's displaced to the right. Well, that will not divvy up the pulmonary trunk and the aorta very well, right? So the aorta will get more space than it should get, aka overriding the aorta. And the pulmonary trunk will get less space than it should get, aka pulmonic stenosis, right? And if the pulmonary trunk is stenosed, then the right ventricle will need to work harder to send blood through it, aka you'll have right ventricular hypertrophy, right? And then because the aortic pulmonary septum is not meeting the muscular interventricular septum nicely in the center, they essentially a conduit will exist between the right and the left ventricle, which is the VSD. So hopefully this makes some sense. I mean, I've essentially talked about the rest of the findings in tetralogy of Fallot in the other podcast. But let me just maybe wrap up this podcast by essentially maybe saying a few more things here real quick, right? So the thing is, people that have tetralogy of Fallot, right, they have, you know, high pressures in the pulmonary system from cyanosis. So the thing is, blood actually flows from the right ventricle to the left ventricle through the VSD. So because blood is flowing from the right to the left ventricle, the blood that is making its way to the aorta from the left ventricle itself is not purely oxygenated. It's actually a mixture of oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. So this is actually why tetralogy of Fallot is a cyanotic defect. Now, the other like congenital defects like truncus arteriosus, transposition of the great vessels, yada, 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 I actually describe those in cardiology, I believe, series 5. So I've already essentially talked about that, so I'm not going to say that anymore. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here because I don't know. I feel like cardiac embryology is one of those things where you just want to be that, let that be the only topic you cover so that people can, again, have time to like listen to the podcast again, understand it, and go from there. And then as I do at the end of every podcast, I offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, and Step 3 exams, and also Step 2 CS. And then I tutor for the preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one coaching for this, right? So like mock interviews, personal statement writing and editing applications, rec letters. Again, I've worked with people on those things. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with, they've all mastered their first choices. And then if you... there's this thing I do called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor you for like your block exams or your shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam. And again, the vast majority of people I've done this with, they've done very well. They've proceeded to do very well on their USMLE tests. It's almost like preparing for step one or step two CQ over a long time period. And then I also do this thing called a USMLE booster course, where it's like 10 hours for step 2 CK or step 3, or 20 hours for step 1. Although if you want a longer period for any of these exams, I can essentially design a longer course for you, but that's more on a case-by-case basis. You just need to request it from me. So these booster courses, they're good for people at the end of their dedicated periods, or people that, you know, feel like their knowledge base is pretty good, so you just want someone to, you know, kind of put everything together for you in a very high yield fashion, like the must know things for the exam. You can review them in a very short time period. That's essentially what I do with those booster courses. And then some people, again, have kind of talked to me about, like, Divine, your course, like your full-on course for step one, or your full-on course for step two CQ, or your full-on course for step three, how can I participate in that? Well, here's the deal. Here's the deal. If you have at least five people that can attend the course, if you can bandy up a group of five, then send me an email, then we can try to arrange a 14-day period where I can essentially do like a course that covers essentially most of what you'll see on step one or step two CK or step three, okay? It just needs a group of five people and a physical location. So if you can get a group of five people and a physical location, then we can take care of that. And then if you have a college student buddy that needs to learn for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Physiology, Histology, offer to learn for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.